Afternoon, council and parties. Welcome to Division 2 of the Court of Appeals. We have one case set for argument this afternoon. J.C. versus Dungarvan. Appears council are present and ready in both in the case.
Yes, sir.
All right. Have the defendants talked about how they want to divide time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll leave for 10 minutes or so, and then my co-defendants will each take a couple of minutes.
All right. Very good. Thank you. I'm sure you're both aware this case is set for 15 minutes per side. You'll be guided by a lighting system which works as follows. When your time commences, the green light on the podium will come on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light will come on, and when your full 15 minutes have expired, the red light will come on. You'll know what your time is by virtue of a clock on the podium that counts backwards from 15. Feel free to adjust the podium up or down as you wish to meet your needs. We would ask you to stay close to the podium, please, because we're recording your arguments, and if you stray from the podium, your voice will not be picked up well. Also be aware that within a few days after today's argument, the arguments are available on the internet. So if there's anything of a very confidential nature that you do not wish to have available on the internet, please be aware of that. We've read the briefs in your case. We're familiar with the facts as you've set them forth, so to the extent you wish to dispense with a discussion of the facts and proceed directly to your legal argument, that's fine with us, but the case is yours to argue as you wish. Finally, if anyone in the audience has a cell phone or a pager, please ensure it's turned off, and we're ready for argument.
May it please the court. Counsel. This case has been in the context of an immunity case, but truly in the statute that we are examining today, it's a civil liability statute. Within that liability statute, it contemplates that service providers for developmentally disabled persons are liable for their actions. It does provide some limitations on liability, specifically subsection 6, when they're discussing the duty to warn or the duty to protect. And this case is far greater than an allegation that an individual who was a therapist or a part-time provider to an individual who was developmentally disabled failed to warn or protect. This is much greater than that. We have a notorious sexual predator. The defendants all knew the full nature of the notoriety and the severity of this man as a sexual predator. He is labeled generically as a mildly developmentally disabled person. He's a low IQ individual. Some birth issues caused a low IQ, but he, during his developmental stage, began assaulting children. 48 reported sexual assaults. Incarceration resulting in management under the Colorado Sex Offender Management Board for his incarceration and subsequent detainment and supervision as a juvenile.
Yeah, counsel, I'm sorry, but you know, your opening brief did not have any record citations, and I was wondering where in the record it established that he was incarcerated and supervised pursuant to the Sex Offenders Management Board.
There is an ABLE Blazing Game assessment that was attached as an exhibit to the one of the motions that discusses it, and there were individualized plans prepared by the defendants attached as exhibits A and B that discussed his incarceration and detainment. I believe it's exhibit A to the response to Dungarvan's motion for summary judgment.
I've seen that one, and if we're talking about the same assessment, there is some fairly vague reference to involvement with the juvenile justice system, and also saying either that in that assessment or a later assessment that those records had been expunged.
Yes.
And so he was not under the supervision of the juvenile justice system at the time that these activities occurred, is that correct?
As of July 4 of 2006, he was no longer a juvenile, he was an adult, no longer under the juvenile system.
And so what would have been the mechanism for employing the Sex Offender Management Board guidelines or procedures?
Those procedures require, in the management of juvenile sex offenders that there is an outtake and a procedure followed regarding the assurance of public protection, the continuity of the provision of the therapeutic measures and the supervisory measures. That was not accomplished. Instead, what was accomplished is as soon as he turned age 21, the defendants ignored the recommendations of the therapist and the Able Blazing Game assessment and withdrew the restrictions. So they didn't follow the protocol required of them of the SOMB.
Counsel, if I can, and is it Mr. Kollerich?
Yes.
You didn't introduce yourself, so
I'll
make sure we have, and I pronounced it right, I hope.
Yes, you did. Okay. Thank you.
Let me ask you, Mr. Kollerich, I guess it's two related questions, and one is picking up on Judge Boris's question. I understand your argument that somehow the defendant should have followed SOMB guidelines, but on what's the legal hook here? If they're not subject, he's not Mr. Perpetrator here was not in the system. What under what authority are these defendants bound by the SOMB guidelines? I recognize separately that they may be approved to be providers under that, but I'm not sure that gets them a duty in this case.
Okay. In this case, it's a matter of continuity, and the fact that he ages 21 does not magically create him a non-sex offender. There is a provision specifically established within the juvenile developmental disability for sex offender guidelines that says this is what you're required to do when he ages out of it, and that wasn't even pursued. In fact, it was ignored, and all restrictions were just withdrawn. So they failed in their basic duties in order to protect, have a continuity of protection of the public. This is a sexual predator. This is perhaps an area in our society that is greatest protection, greatest protection. It's also of children. It's the area in our society under public policy is the area in need of greatest protection. That's why we have this very solid statutory authority that sets up standards of practice. What more of a duty of care is something that's called a standard of practice?
Well, let's assume, Mr. Kollerich, if we will, and let me make sure I understand your argument. I think you look at 1321.117.5 that says there's a duty, if there's a duty imposed, or a duty can be imposed by federal or state law or, you know, rules and regs, whatever it says. And I think that's the hook in which you say, okay, so there's a duty here.
Yes.
Do I understand you correctly about that?
That's correct.
All right. Could you then help me understand how that provision squares or fits together with 117.56, which creates the immunity? Even if there's a duty, you still have this problem of 117.56 that says it's immune. And the legislature has made a call that, in terms of public policy, it's important to make sure providers will provide these services and not have the specter of liability come up, specifically because there's a risk of assaults, which is mentioned in the statute. So,
yes.
Well, I didn't mean to go on so long, but how did these two provisions fit together?
Well, they fit together precisely in the context of the allegations of our complaint and the facts which support them, in that the limitation of liability, it says there is, if you have a duty of care, if it exists, we'll give you this limitation. No duty for failure to warn or protect, okay? What we have is a greater responsibility. We have companies that undertook for profit to provide line-of-sight supervised oversight and housing, and the only therapeutic measures he received were from a sex offender counselor and not from an occupational therapist or a physical therapist. Mr. Cooks was capable of performing all measures of daily activities except for he had to be confined. So they have a duty that's greater than to warn or protect.
But your claim, Mr. Kollerich, as I understood it,
yes,
was a failure to warn or protect.
We have additional claims within there. I separate out different allegations. And it's interesting to note at the outset of this, Dungarvan and Carmel filed answers and affirmative defenses not asserting this as liability. And the Resource Exchange is a nonprofit, dug deeper and relied upon this, and then they were piggybacked. So I think that this, from the outset, has kind of been a grasp for a limitation of liability. It's really not an immunity, except it limits liability for that for those causes of action, but our complaint also alleges a greater level of responsibility under the SOMB to manage and control. That's not hearing something and considering whether or not under your physician-client or physician-patient relationship you have a duty to protect that, or you have a duty to disclose because it's a violent propensity. We have a greater thing than that. We have a duty in which they undertook to manage this individual who is a known sex offender and to control it.
Counsel, when you say manage and control, the language of the statute also says prevent such behavior.
Yes.
Are we talking about manage and control being something different than prevent? And if so, why?
It's to prevent behavior over which they had a duty to warn or protect, which I submit is a type of duty that people have, but people have professionals have a variety of duties. They may have a duty in treatment to do something more than to warn and protect. It may be to undertake reasonable or generally accepted measures of practice. And in this instance, we submit that they failed to undertake generally accepted and measured practice to protect the public against a known sex offender. And again, because he became 21, and his records, his juvenile records, were somehow expunged, although Colorado law prohibits expungement
of criminal. How is protection different than prevention?
How is protection?
You said they have a duty of protection, but how is that different than prevention?
I mean a duty to manage and control.
Okay, well, how is that different than a duty to protect?
It is a responsibility that they undertook to make sure that that person is maintained, okay, and that his activities are monitored and that they are controlled, okay? So a therapist, warn and protect, is they see them for the hour of the day and they hear a violent propensity or proclivity. The issue is whether or not they have a duty to disclose that and whether or not they're liable for something they heard. They are liable for something that they have to do under guidelines. They have these management and control obligations under the SOMB, these standards. And that's a greater thing than hearing something and communicating or not. It's an actual management and control of an individual who, if not managed and controlled, will harm someone, and who, after receiving notice, after they took away his, or after they restored his freedoms, and knowing that there were some issues of concern, nothing was done to prevent him from going to a party with 50 kids.
I guess I have a bit of concern with where this argument goes, Mr. Collark, and perhaps you can help me figure out where the line is. If we say there's a duty to manage and control, it seems to me that very quickly swallows the immunity. Because what's always going to happen in these cases in management, somebody gets hurt, and there's no question your clients, you know, were hurt here. But the problem is, you can always say, well, they got hurt because you didn't manage and control, and we've gotten away, the immunity's gone. I fear the exception you're seeing in Ukraine is going to swallow the rule.
Easily managed in the context of the evaluation of factual evidence. If by fact they hear something, then they should warn or prevent, that's one thing. If they have an obligation to actively undertake a management of somebody, it's a different and higher obligation, it's a greater duty. So from a factual standpoint, the trier of fact can determine should they have managed them and controlled them, or should they have listened and communicated. It's a very easy distinction that the trier of fact can make. And I would like to preserve the remaining time.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Teresa Sidebotham of Rothkerber Johnson & Lyons, attorney number 36713, and my client is the Resource Exchange. Your Honors, in this case, plaintiffs are asking the court to ignore the plain language of the statute and to revise the state of legislative policy in order to permit them to bring barred claims. In addition, plaintiffs are making arguments based outside the record and arguments based on facts that are not found in the record cannot provide a basis for a decision from this court. I want to start by talking about the legislative policy here, which was so important to the legislature that it's actually enacted into the statute, CRS 1321.117.5. The legislature stated that it wanted persons with developmental disabilities to be able to live in integrated community settings instead of being shut away from the community. Being shut away might keep them safer, might keep other people safer, but the legislature felt that it was best for them to live in the community. And the legislature expressed that there are inherent risks to having these persons integrated into the community because of their cognitive limitations and possibly at some times because of other problems. So the legislature considered whether to make the service providers the guarantors of their clients' conduct. And it determined it did not want to do that for two reasons. The first is it could alter, it could affect the provision of services by making it prohibitively expensive, and it could discourage service providers from even taking on the task. There's already a chronic shortage of cash to provide these services, and there's a waiting list for adults with developmental disabilities that can stretch out for years. And the statutes show that the legislature is chronically concerned with finding this cash and shortening these waiting lists. So this is the context of the legislative policy that controls the statutes.
Ms. Ibotham, if I can ask you a similar question I asked Mr. Collard. The legislature also wrote into the statute or acknowledged in subsection 4 that there may be duties expressly imposed by federal or state law or department rule. Obviously, Mr. Collard argues that the SOMB guidelines created expressly some other duty. I guess my question for you is, what's the purpose of that section that acknowledges there may be duties created by state or federal law?
Well, Your Honor, I think the legislator took a two-pronged approach to limit liability. It goes at two of the aspects of the negligence claim. Subsection 4 targets the duty of care, and it limits the duty of care. It says that, generally speaking, providing for a person with a developmental disability doesn't create a duty of care to third persons, and there is no duty of care to third persons unless it's expressly imposed by some other law outside the statute. Subsection 6 targets the damages prong of a negligence claim.
Sure, but if I can interrupt you for a second,
sure.
So we don't lose the thought. So what is, if there is a duty of care imposed by other law, is there a remedy for breach of that duty? Same question I asked Mr. Collard. How does that fit together with the immunity?
Well, Your Honor, supposing there was a duty of care imposed, that could cover a broad range of claims, and there would be a duty of care for that range of claims. Subsection 6 is a little more narrowly focused, just for damages for harassing or assaultive or generally violent behavior. So if the particular claim fell within that failure to warn and protect or prevent that kind of behavior, it would be once again barred. There could be a duty of care, but the damages could be barred. So subsection 4 is a little broader and might get around subsection 6 depending on the type of claim, but in this particular claim, Your Honor, it's barred by both subsections. There's no express duty of care, and there's no possibility of getting damages because of the, you know, under the assaultive and harassing behavior.
Ms. Ibotham, what about the argument that the failure to follow the age out procedure when the SOMB guidelines basically arguably terminated, would that failure have created an express duty of care?
Well, no, Your Honor. A couple of points here. One is that I don't think plaintiff has met his burden to establish that defendants are, in fact, operating under the sex offender management scheme. We may be listed as providers, but that doesn't mean that we have a duty to any particular individual whom we service. But the second thing is, even in that case, the sex offender management scheme doesn't provide an express duty of care to a private individual. That's simply not part of the purpose of that scheme. was Colorado Sex Offender Lifetime Supervision Act provides a number of duties to the judicial department, the management board, the parole board. It doesn't have any express right of action for a private person. So the legislative statement of that statute is for the safety, health, and welfare of the state. Now, I know plaintiffs have referenced a vague reference to civil liability for negligence in one of the regulations. That does not provide an express duty of care for the resource exchange because it's not specific enough. It doesn't say, you know, what type of claim, who can assert that claim. I understand this would have to be an express right of action for a private third party completely outside that. And I think it helps in the analysis to look at what you have to have a private right of action under statute that doesn't expressly provide that. You have to show that you're intended to be a member of the class that's intended to be benefited, that the legislature intended to create a private right of action, and that such a private right of action would be consistent with the purposes of the legislative scheme. Well, the plaintiffs haven't shown any of these elements, and they can't do that because an implied private right of action would completely destroy the sex offender management scheme. I mean, imagine how unworkable it would be if every victim of a subsequent sex assault by a supervised sex offender could come back for financial damages against the sex offender management providers. That's completely outside the scope of that scheme, which the state has instituted for other purposes. And so, well, and another thing that shows that it's outside the scope of that scheme is the sex offender management scheme has extensive administrative remedies. People are protected under that scheme by the supervision. If service providers fail under that scheme, they can have their licenses removed, they can be admonished, they can have to undergo training, there's a complaint process, an appeals process. That's how the state has chosen to manage that scheme, not with a private right of action. So even in the event that plaintiff had shown that we were responsible under that scheme, we would argue that that does not create an express duty of care under subsection 4. It's analogous to the case in Davenport. In that case, the plaintiff tried to recover damages against a correctional institute, a halfway house, actually. And the plaintiff said, well, you allowed your resident to violate the rules of the facility. He went out, he got drunk, he operated a vehicle, and he disabled me. And so because you didn't properly supervise your resident, I should be able to come back and get monetary damages for this. And the court said, no, this plaintiff was an incidental beneficiary of that statute that regulated the correctional institute or halfway house. And it's very similar in this case. And so, sorry, did you say something?
No.
I thought you started to. So because there's no private right of action under the sex offender management scheme, there's no express duty of care, we are still sheltered under subsection 4 of the disability provider scheme.
Is there any I recognize the context here, Ms. Sidebotham, was summary judgment. Is there any issue about the fact that your clients, all they were part of this interdisciplinary team, and they made decisions regarding this perpetrator sex offender status? For example, they decided we didn't need 24-hour line of sight, and they made decisions that seemed specific to the sex offender nature of some of these issues. Does that in any way create, or is there, can it raise a fact question as to whether there's a duty here? Did your clients undertake some duty by addressing those issues? It seems a little more to me than just we didn't sign up for the sex offender part, so we don't have to deal with it. It seems like they took some action recognizing that the perpetrator here was a sex offender.
Your Honor, if they took action under the sex offender management scheme, and if they had responsibilities under that, the remedies for any failure there are administrative remedies. They don't open up this statute for damages for the plaintiff. The situation, I mean, we all recognize it's a really sad situation. but the case falls squarely within the statute and the reason that the statute was written. The legislature weighed out the competing interests and decided not to make service providers the guarantors of conduct for the people they serve in order to protect the thousands of people who have developmental disabilities in the system and to make the resources available for the people on the waiting list waiting for the care. So, Your Honor, we ask the court to apply the plain language of the statute, to apply the legislature's clearly stated policy, and affirm the trial court's orders dismissing the action. And I'm going to have my co-defendants take the rest of the time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Mark Kane. I'm with the Kane Law Firm. I represent the Carmel Community Living Corporation. I think the immunity that is provided for by 1321.117.5 applies here. Specifically, my client is also under attack based on an allegation that there wasn't adequate proof provided in my motion for summary judgment that they are a program approved service agency for the state of Colorado. I would submit to you that the affidavit I provided, as well as the correspondence and the approval renewal, all shift the burden to the plaintiff. Plaintiff didn't answer that burden. Plaintiff offered no evidence of any type that my client is not an approved provider. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Your Honor's counsel. My name is Richard Waltz, 11567. I represent the Dungarvan defendants in this matter. My firm does. I would incorporate and adopt the arguments made by Mr. Kane and Ms. Sidebottom, and I will not repeat any of those as it relates specifically to the arguments made against Dungarvan in plaintiff's brief and reply brief as it relates to whether Dungarvan was or was not an approved agency. I would merely point out to the court that the affidavit by Mr. Solano, responsible for overseeing this program, has created no doubt that my client, LLC, was in fact an approved agency at the time of this incident. Having provided that to the trial court, that shifted the burden, we believe, of persuasion to the plaintiff. Nothing was filed in response to that. We believe, therefore, it has to be accepted as fact. Therefore, we believe there's no question that Dungarvan's entitled to immunity. And I finish by saying this. I understand the court's concern. No one can read what occurred here and have anything but utter offense to Mr. The offender and sympathy for the parents. Everyone knows that. The very reason why the legislature, we believe, has enacted the statute and provided protections for these providers, such as my client, is that it is foreseeable, very foreseeable, that bad things will happen with developmentally disabled people who, in this case and other cases, have some violent tendencies, and the statute speaks to that. And that is the very reason for the protection. Otherwise, you'll get into issues about whether you did or did not approve of a plan of action. You'll have experts coming in saying you don't do that, and the legislature saw that coming. It's a volatile area, and protection is absolutely necessary for these providers. Thank you very much.
Mr. Waltz, before you leave, the statute talks about no liability for predicting or preventing such behavior. In your view, does that go beyond? Is that broader than or narrower than the plaintiff's contention that there's a duty to manage and control?
I think it's broader than, Your Honor. I believe that protection is very, very broad. And there's the reason I just expressed to the court and to in our brief is why they've done that. They have to have that protection. I mean, you cannot have people coming in and raising questions of fact about decisions you're making when we're talking about developmentally disabled people. We're not talking about criminals. That's the problem. And my client did not contract to take care of criminals, contracted to take care of developmentally disabled people. I hope I responded to your inquiry.
Mr. Waltz, let me follow up then. In what context does the exception in subsection 4 apply then, if there's an express duty under federal or state law? It seems to me the kinds of claims we're going to be talking about are exactly what happened here, and I'm trying to figure out when that exception would ever apply. It seems to me you'd always have the immunity argument.
Well, I think that's not true, Your Honor, in the event that you do have information that it would be dangerous to a specific individual.
But that's specifically covered in this, in a different part of the statute, I recognize, and I know your time's up, but if it's to answer the question here, and, you know, maybe it's a contract duty, but let's say, I'll put it as a hypothetical. If the SOMB guidelines created a duty, and I fully understand you said they didn't, and I understand Ms. Sidebottom's argument, if they did, would that create liability here, or does the immunity still apply?
I believe it's the defendant's position, it's certainly my client's position that it would not, under the facts of this case.
I'm sorry,
it would not, under the facts of this case.
It would not create a liability?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and on behalf of Mason Culver and his parents, Jay Culver and Christy Culver, who will join us, thank you for your interest in this. And again, this is a matter of great public importance. This is an undertaking for profit to manage a known sex offender, someone who is violent and dangerous. They make a determination that they can save some costs, and they take away his restrictions, and immediately thereafter, he assaults a young man. And in this case, Carmel had no response, no rebutting affidavit or evidence to the August 18 of 2006 statement that it had just been approved as a servants agency 6 weeks after the offense.
Well, what evidence did you submit on that, Mr. Collard? I have to tell you, you didn't cite anything in your brief. It's at page 22. You say they're approved later. You cited nothing.
It was an exhibit attached to the response to the Carmel motion for summary judgment, which was, I believe, was referenced within the argument.
Right. And I know you have very little time.
What's,
excuse me. Can you cite me a case that supports your position? Case law that supports the position you're taking here as to why the immunity doesn't apply.
Well, I would submit that this is a common law negligence claim, okay, that there's a civil liability posture set up within 1321.17.5 that limits liability under certain claims but doesn't prohibit those. The fact that it's a common law negligence claim, that would be Humphrey versus Whole Foods Market, Rocky Mountain, Southwest LP. The result of this case is that the entire public, there's potential impact if providers of services to sex offenders are immune from liability if that sex offender is of low IQ, somehow developmentally disabled. It takes away a statutory scheme that was specifically established to protect, except in a limited situation of failure to warn or prevent. And what we have is an affirmative duty to undertake 24-hour line of sight supervision and to make sure that this violent person is protected against society, and they chose for profit reasons to do that, and it's of great importance to this society. Thousands of children are assaulted by sexual predators. Many sexual predators undertake the defense of being of low IQ. It complicates a situation when they receive governmental benefits to pay for their care. They're receiving a profit to cover these people. They know they have these standards. They know they're violent. And they know they must protect, and yet they don't do it because it helps them beneficially for profit. There are too many factual issues here to ignore, factual issues about whether Carmel and Dungarvan were in fact approved at the time or whether after this assault they scrambled in the next 4 to 6 weeks to accomplish that, and whether or not as a provider to a sex offender that they are required to undertake those standards and follow them and actually make sure that the public and children are protected from a sexual predator by doing the appropriate outtake interview and make sure there's a transition of the professionalism and completeness of the protection of society. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. That concludes our docket for the day. Court will be in recess. The bailiff may sign out.